So as we sit here and as workers and as companies and as society, we try to figure out, well, how is this, all this going to impact? It would be very strange to have that thought and to try to peer into the future without looking at the past and how we've done it before. And I'm not saying it's going to happen exactly the same way, but history does tend to rhyme.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Future of Work Project. My name is Derek Franco, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this program dedicated to bringing together smart and thoughtful leaders and innovators experimenting with new and unique ways of working. From remote work and culture to research into the peak performance of human beings, we'll learn alongside these experts pushing the boundaries today. Today's guest is author and entrepreneur Jeff Wald. Now, Jeff has a wide-ranging background that includes time in private equity and venture capital, to also co-founding Work Market, which sold in 2019 to ADP. Jeff is also the author of two books, with his most recent publication being The End of Jobs. Now, this book reviews the history of work to help us gain insight and understand how companies and workers reacted to the last three industrial revolutions. It does this to help us predict how the workforce and markets may react to the coming changes that AI and automation may bring. The book also contains insights from some of the best thought leaders from around the world, thanks to Jeff's $10 million Future of Work competition. The competition focused on bringing together a group of 20 leading global thinkers on the future of work to use both data and their insight to help predict how the workforce may change and adapt into 2040. During our discussion, Jeff dives into these predictions for the future of work based on three bodies of evidence: history, data, and how companies are already engaging their workers. We also take a look at how flexibility and the de-densification of the office will lead to huge productivity advantages for larger companies. And finally, we touch on how the technical revolutions of AI and automation will affect the workforce and how retraining efforts need to be brought to the forefront of conversations. And with that said, it's my great pleasure to welcome Jeff Wald. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and chat today.
Thank you so much for having me, Derek.
Yeah, of course, of course. And, you know, before we really kind of dive into everything, you know, I'd love if we could just start by learning a little bit more about, you know, some of your past endeavors and some of the things that you've recently built as well.
Well, you know, I started my startup journey about 15 years ago. I was at a venture firm and looking at startups, and I was so enamored with entrepreneurs and how people were trying to change the world and find inefficiencies. And my boss at one point said, "You have to stop fawning over these people in meetings." Because I'd sit there and be like, "You guys are so great. Oh, what you're doing is so great." He's like, "Jeff, we have to negotiate with these people." He said, "If you're so in love with startups and founders, why don't you leave and start your own company? We'll back you." And so I took half of his advice as I left and started my own company. I didn't let them back me, which led my the first company, when it failed, and it failed miserably, nearly bankrupted me. And, you know, it's tough to get that call at 32 to, do you need to move back home from your mom? But yeah, at the same time, you're fortunate enough to get it. But, you know, look, Derek, as you know, as well as I, startups, you know, involve a lot of failure. And, yeah, you know, I like to say that failure is not only an option in startup land, it's the most likely outcome. We spend a lot of time glorifying the wins, but the wins are very unlikely. And so, you know, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you get back in it. And I did that a few times. And the most recent one was a company called Work Market. We raised about $70 million from Union Square Ventures, SoftBank, and a few others. And we were fortunate enough to sell the company almost 3 years ago to ADP. And so I have actually just left ADP, and I'm thinking about now my fifth startup. So we'll see where we go.
No, that's amazing. So you guys sell the company to ADP. Like you said, you take your time there. You're just stepping back. And it looks like during that time and after that time, you really kind of started your focus on really kind of what would be the next technological revolution. And, you know, before we kind of dive into those pieces, I'd love to kind of learn, how did you kind of get on this topic originally? And you know, what led you down that rabbit hole?
Well, what led me down the rabbit hole of kind of writing the book, just to use that as the jump point, is frustration. It's frustration with people that make predictions about the future of work that aren't based in evidence. And so I'm a big believer in data and using evidence. In the world of work, I think there are three main bodies of evidence: the history of work, the data surrounding the world of work, data trends and patterns, and how companies actually engage workers. And I, over the time I was building and running Work Market, would run into too many people at conferences, on panels, that were opening their mouths and they should not have been. Like, you have a responsibility if you're a quote unquote thought leader. You have a responsibility if you're on stage to have a grounding in what you're saying. And it got very frustrating. So I started to write a book that looked at the world of work and predicted the future of work based on the history of work, the data, and how companies actually engage workers. And so it was frustration and annoyance that led me down that path.
I mean, you hit a point. I mean, it seems like everybody wants to be a thought leader, but it's exactly that. It's, you know, are they just kind of running their mouth on the first idea that pops in their mind, or do they have something to back it up?
I will tell you this story. This happened literally just the other day. I was on a panel and they said, what are your predictions? Percent of the workforce that is remote in 21, 22, right when we're out of COVID. And one of the panelists jumps in, he goes, well, I've been thinking a lot about this and it's going to be 50% of the workforce. And I just thought, really? That's super interesting. How do you juxtapose your 50% prediction with the fact that only 42% of the workforce can work remotely? Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I didn't know that. And I said, well, you really should know that. Now, I'm probably not going to get invited back to that panel and that organization, but it is super frustrating. You can't open your mouth and make that statement when people are starting to do resource planning, when families are starting to make their plans. You have a responsibility and it's very frustrating.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I mean, you hit it perfectly. It's, you know, people are going to be, especially right now in such a crazy time that we are in that, you know, kind of COVID thrust us into, people are trying to figure out what those kind of next steps look like. And, you know, it's actually a tangent I'd love to kind of pull that thread on a little bit as well. You know, as work has shifted with COVID and everything that's happened this last couple of years, what do you realistically foresee work being like, I guess, over the next, let's just say the next year? You know, so we're starting going into 2021. What does that potential work landscape look like? What should people kind of prepare for that next 12-month cycle?
I will say, Derek, I think you're hitting the nail on the head. I would anticipate that work is not very different than what it is now for the next 9 months. I think the overarching change that you'll see, you'll certainly see more people work remote. It won't be 50% because that's mathematically impossible. You'll see about 8% of the U.S. workforce work remote. And definitions are important here. Remote means more than 50% of the time you are not in that office, meaning from a tax nexus standpoint, your office location is your home or another location. So you're not being taxed as a commuter. And from an infrastructure standpoint, your company doesn't necessarily have to allocate square footage to you. And so 8% is actually a very high number because we were at 3% pre-pandemic. But if you were to ask me what percentage of the workforce is going to have a flexible work arrangement, now I'm up to 32, 33% of the workforce. So the vast majority of that 42% that can. So I think the hallmark of what the world of work looks like is defined by that flexible work arrangement where people are going to find new ways, whether it's remote or flexible or part-time here or offshore there or this or that. People are going to find their own ways of doing work and companies are going to be very supportive of it. Whereas before, companies were not overly supportive of flexible work arrangements or remote work.
Yeah, yeah. You know, for businesses that were very heavily focused on, you know, having a centralized office, it seems like work's kind of changed for them forever. And, you know, I'd love to kind of pull out that thread that you mentioned, this kind of like flexible work arrangement. What do you think the offices of the future may look like? Is it something where it's, you know, people are still kind of coming into that central hub office? Are there more of kind of a office space near them that they're going to versus commuting, you know, all the way to one central location? What could that potentially look like?
So the short answer is nobody knows. Right? Like, we just don't know. I think you will see, ironically, more of the WeWork type situations where companies are outsourcing their office space needs because the office space needs are so flexible, they need to have a flexible environment versus taking a 10-year lease in a central location for a lot of square feet. I think you'll see the WeWorks, which right now are very focused on major cities, expand to many, many more areas, including suburban locations. I saw a startup called HQ2, which, full disclosure, I'm an angel investor in, that is building out in strip malls, just little like 5,000 foot square foot templates where you'd go in and, you know, spend some time doing some work because you just need a break from your home. So I think there are going to be a lot of different things that happen that encompass the office. But the idea of everybody coming to a central location is not fully dead, right? And we shouldn't write its obituary. It will just be slowly pulled at its edges. And the office will be de-densified, which will be a big word in kind of the office culture, to de-densify. It will have a lot more collaboration space. But it is important to keep in mind, Eric, that 93% of the people that work remotely work within a commuting distance of the office. Mm-hmm. And so it is one thing to have a completely distributed teams, which some companies, especially younger companies and innovative companies, can do. Most companies can't. And so they'll let people have a more flexible work arrangement. They'll let people go fully remote, which fully remote, again, means more than 50% of the time. So it might be 10% of the time you're in the office. So the office will slowly lose market share, but it will be far, far, far from dead.
Kind of going back to what you mentioned with HQ2, right before the pandemic hit, you know, I mentioned to you before the conversation that my wife is from Georgia. And when we went back to the Atlanta area, when we were visiting her family, that's exactly one of the co-working spaces I ran into. They literally had redone the second floor of an old department store at a mall. And it was huge. They had, you know, multiple office spaces. They had a coffee shop inside. And yeah, I mean, to me, it just made perfect sense because there's all this infrastructure that was just kind of in decay that, you know, is not only able to be reused, but is a cheaper price. And mm-hmm. just like you said, it comes back to flexibility. And I think that's one thing that, for me, I'm very excited about kind of this next evolution for flexibility, because one of the reasons that we did remote first was we knew the flexibility for us is like a superpower. You know, your workers are most likely going to be happier if they're able to kind of choose, you know, one, when they're most productive and, you know, are able to kind of fit their lives around work versus, you know, work kind of being the main center and you're fitting everything else. I guess, are you seeing other advantages from this potential flexibility kind of coming into play? Especially, you know, just as you mentioned, at companies that are much bigger, that are less likely to go fully decentralized, but just give more of the flexibility.
There were studies done pre-COVID, big studies by Stanford University, by Google, by Microsoft, very long-range studies that looked at the productivity, that looked at the health mm-hmm. and wellness and happiness, that looked at cost, that looked at retention, and all of those things. All of those things led to, wow, we should have more people with flexible work arrangements and working remotely because they're happier, they're healthier, they cost us less, it costs the worker less, they have higher retention rates. Like every single thing was a benefit to the company and to the worker. And so it was funny, whenever I would talk with CEOs or heads of divisions and they were very anti-remote work, and I would say, why? And they would say, well, I think productivity equals presence. I think magic happens when people are together. I said, okay, well, what are you basing that on? Like, what data are you looking at? What's happening at your company? Like, what analysis have you done? And they would say, well, nothing. It's my gut. I was like, okay, I don't know how to debate you if it's your gut. I don't know what that means. Here are actual studies done by researchers with very long study sizes, very long sample sizes. This is data. I don't know what to do with your gut.
No, and I think it's a great point because especially, you know, I mean, people say all the time, COVID kind of may have accelerated this flexible work arrangement by, you know, 10 years because people were forced to kind of go into it. And, you know, I think a good question to ask is, you know, a lot of people, if this is their first time remote, they look at it in kind of a negative light depending on their circumstances, which is, you know, if you've got a lot of kids at home and, you know, you're trying to deal with either online learning or, you know, both. You know, maybe you and your partner are working at home at the same time, it can get a little rough. But I think this is kind of the biggest distinction is this is working remote in a pandemic versus, you know, flexible working at all the time. And I think that's kind of the biggest piece to point out to people is this is the worst case scenario for remote work. You know, most of the time I look at it and look at the benefits. And I think that people will see that more and more as we eventually get out of COVID.
You're 100% right, Derek. And it's a point that gets lost a lot as people have this debate on remote work. They're like, oh, well, productivity is not necessarily that much better. I'm like, it's a freaking pandemic, man. People are being childcare providers and teachers, and they have no social outlet, and they're freaking out, and they're depressed. The fact that it's even remotely close should be mind-blowing to you.
Yep, exactly.
Like, let's see what happens when we are, God willing, soon in a post-COVID world. you will see productivity tremendously increase. And most companies in most industries and most job functions are seeing productivity increases even in this context.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the huge factor for sure is, you know, if we had COVID 20 years ago, there's no way we keep productivity at these levels in the same kind of aspect.
Absolutely correct.
So, you know, one thing I'd love to kind of go back to, and, you know, I know, you know, you mentioned it earlier before, but, you know, the new book that you just wrote, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, it's The End of Jobs, correct?
That is correct.
You touch on a lot of great things in the book, but one thing in particular that I really would love to dive into is kind of, you know, what you're talking about with these next technical revolutions. And, you know, really focusing on kind of AI and automation in particular. I'd wonder if you could kind of give us just a quick, even if it's just a quick summary of what you're thinking of as far as these revolutions go. And, you know, then we can kind of dive into a little more of kind of the subtopics there.
So the thing is, Derek, that this is not the first time that companies, workers, and societies have struggled with a huge step function of technological change, which leads to huge increases in productivity, which leads to the thought that companies are going to need fewer and fewer and fewer workers. We've done this at least three times on a mass scale before, and they're known as the three industrial revolutions: mechanization, electrification, and computerization. So as we sit here and as workers and as companies and as society, we try to figure out, well, how is this, all this going to impact all of our constituencies? It would be very strange to have that thought and to try to peer into the future without looking at the past and how we've done it before. And I'm not saying it's going to happen exactly the same way, but history does tend to rhyme. And so that is one of the main thrusts of the book, is to look at the first three industrial revolutions and how companies, workers, and societies adapted. And what tends to happen is that this huge power imbalance gets created because of the technological change. People freak out, counterbalancing forces rise, regulation, unions, a social safety net, and we get to some parity, and we end up with more jobs, with a higher standard of living, with people working fewer hours. That is what historically has happened. Now, there are substantive reasons to think that potentially this time is different, but there are equally substantive reasons to believe that this is going to play out in the same way. It may play out quicker. It may play out on a much more global scale, but that is one of, again, the most important lessons from the book, is to read about how these things have happened in the past in order to start informing ourselves as we think about prognosticating about how robots and AI may impact us today.
No, and I think that's a great point, because I feel like a lot of people, when they hear, you know, either one of the terms, when they hear AI, artificial intelligence, automation, they fear about job security. They fear that, you know, they could be replaced. But I feel like this has always been a fear for every technological revolution, correct?
100%. I keep trying to find the quote because somebody said it to me and then I keep Googling it and trying to find it. But it was either Aristotle or Plato that said, you know, if machines improve but a little bit more, there'll be no need for human labor. And so, you know, going back to antiquity, this was a concern of humanity. And look, I'm not saying it's not a valid concern. I don't mean to be dismissive of it. I'm just saying that historically, that has not been the case. Now, that is not to say that certain industries do not get completely decimated in this regard. All the jobs get lost in the industry. Of course, that happens. It is to say, though, that other industries rise, that the demand created because of the decreased cost of products means more people need to be hired in those industries and geographies and job functions. And so to me, the doom of the stories from history, the doom that we face from Skynet, right, the Skynet scenario of the robots taking over, is not technological unemployment. It is the exacerbation of existing gaps in society, because we don't help the workers that whose jobs are lost to be retrained to move to the jobs that are being created.
Yes. And I think that's probably the biggest point there too is, you know, I mean, kind of looking back at what you were saying, you know, historically you can look at the horse and buggy scenario where, you know, everybody's running around on horse and buggies. You have, you know, people that are selling you horses, people that are cleaning up crap in the streets, you know, people that are selling you feed, and then you have the car come around. And, you know, that completely displaces all of those industries, but now you need gas stations, you need places that'll service the car. So just as you mentioned, it will be replaced by new pieces, but it's a matter of, can these people learn the new skills coming in? And I think that's probably a great point to go in on is this retraining idea, because I think that's where that's where I feel like we've fallen short on people is people go and dive in down, you know, a rabbit hole of learning a specific trade. If that gets taken out, it's like, well, crap, what do I do? And there's nothing really there to support the retraining. And I guess, does the internet help change that this time around, or does it almost accelerate that?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. One, I would say it's not just a recent failing, although it is a pronounced recent failing of American society for the 8 million manufacturing jobs that were lost in this country from 1980 to the early 2000s, that we did a terrible job helping those workers to retrain into the high growth, high tech jobs that were being created. But I would say you can find this in examples all through the history of work, all through the three industrial revolutions of societies all over the globe doing a bad job at doing this retraining. Now, to your point, emerging technologies, whether they're online trainings or the MOOCs, which you know, certainly are helping to democratize education and skills creation, or virtual reality skills training. There are some amazing, amazing companies. There's a company called Transfer VR, which I'm involved with, that can compress by like 90% the amount of time, the amount of cost that it takes for someone to be ready to start on the manufacturing line, to start as a electrician or whatever job skill. Those kinds of things exist today, and they did not before. So we should be able to be much better at it. But it raises the question, though, of who is better at it, right? Is that a personal responsibility for me? Is that, because that's a very clear trend in the world of work. More responsibility for my own training, my development, my healthcare, my retirement onto the individual worker. Okay. Is it the company that says, you know what? We can't wait for anybody else to do it. We got to do it. We got to own it. Is it the education system? Is it vocational schools, two-year colleges, and things like that that own it? High schools? You know, what kind of role does government play in incentivizing individuals or companies in the education system? All these are massive unknowns, and we are dealing with not just 8 million manufacturing workers, we are dealing with upwards of 25 million workers over the next 20 years that are going to lose their jobs to robots and AI. And that is a huge amount. It is about 10 to 15% of the US labor force. But we can do a much better job, but we have to be thoughtful of it and starting to have these conversations now.
No, 100%. And I think that's the biggest piece is, you know, this is, you know, we used to, the way that I look at things is we used to look at pieces and be able to identify them by the decades. You know, the 70s were very unique in their own right. The 80s were, I mean, now it feels like, you know, so much is happening every 2 years. You can't put it all into a decade anymore. And it's kind of with that same evolution on, you know, with the retraining process. It's, you may focus on something for 4 years, but it may be completely irrelevant in 10.
Well, I'll tell you this. Let's hope that 2020 is its own
yes.
year, its own thing, its own category. We'll leave that aside. But you are completely correct. It used to be, from a skills training standpoint, that people would have confidence that you did your bulk of your skills education between 18 and 24, and you can take that and monetize it for the rest of your life. And now we are, on average, 4 to 6 years for a skill to become obsolete. And it is a term that might get overused. I would argue it's not used enough, which is lifelong learners. And anybody that thinks, no, I'm done learning, I'm good now, they're going to be in trouble. And we need to make sure that they don't get into that mindset, because everybody needs to be a lifelong learner to make sure that they have skills that are monetizable.
That's going to be the biggest shift, is people are going to have to focus on that in order to, just like you mentioned before, retrain to the skill set of kind of the new landscape that we've been kind of handed. And, you know, one thing that in particular I'm really curious on, just because it's changing so much, especially after this, the last election, the on-demand labor. So, you know, you've had a lot of these, you know, we can call it the gig economy that's come up, whether it's, you know, on the Postmates side, Uber, Lyft. And it seems like people are kind of, you know, a lot of people do like the fact that they can use it to get a little side salary, but more and more people are diving into it as kind of full-time work. And, you know, I'd love if we could kind of unpack a little bit on, you know, your thoughts on the gig economy and, you know, what it may look like over the next couple of years.
So the thing about the gig economy versus the on-demand economy, right? This notion of Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and Postmates and all these other companies, look, they represent a decent chunk of the gig economy, but a very small percentage of the on-demand economy. You know, maybe 5 to 7% of the entire on-demand economy. This idea that people could be engaged by a company when they need, that doesn't just happen as an Uber driver, it happens as a temp, would be the biggest example and the most spend in the on-demand economy. The on-demand economy, Derek, has been around for a very long time. for generations, and it has been about the same size. It has grown over the last 10 years, and it's taken about 3% market share over a 10-year period. It went from about 25 to 27% of the labor force to about 28 to 30% of the labor force. So that you know, those are big movements, but it's over a decade. What I used to say is that there is a tension between companies wanting to be agile and have more on-demand labor, and it helps them be more flexible, and that's a good thing most for the most part, and the regulatory environment, right? One is this big tailwind pushing the on-demand economy forward, and the other was a big headwind just smacking into it. And if you had asked me who was going to win that fight, I would say regulation. And to your point, we had a very, very big movement that I don't think is getting nearly enough press, and that's Prop 22 in California, where the voters basically said, and I don't mean to sound overly glib here, but voters basically said, do what you will with that Uber driver. I don't want to pay more or wait longer for a car to come here. And that was the argument that Uber made, right? Do you want to wait 5 more minutes, and do you want to pay 30% more for your ride? Because if you do, then, you know, vote yes or vote no. I don't remember which one was whatever. So that was dangerous because you're asking people to not to make a choice based on, I would argue, incorrect information, because the implications are much greater than that for the workers. So the movement in Prop 22, I think, is going to be a very big movement that now moves from being a big headwind to the market to a big tailwind. That this movement, because outside of Prop 22, I can tell you this, because Prop 22 changed what was known as California's AB 5, which was their law clamping down. There were a lot of states that would have passed laws similar to AB 5 if not for COVID. COVID obviously put everything on the back burner. We have a much more substantive issue to deal with as a society. But if not for COVID, we would have seen many other states pass laws very similar.
Would you mind if we kind of give a little bit of description of what AB 5 was specifically looking at, especially when it comes in terms of the gig economy?
So AB 5 was very specifically looking at Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and Postmates and other companies in the gig economy and saying, if you as a platform are engaging these workers, they should be employees of yours, not freelancers. Meaning, you have to abide by minimum wage laws, you have to pay payroll taxes, you have to provide those people with health care. And the companies claimed if we do that, our business models are ruined. And their business models are substantively impacted, there's no question. And so they, you know, when California's AB 5 law got passed, I mean, all their stocks dropped by 20, 30%, right? This was a huge, huge, huge impact versus when Prop 22 passed, all their stocks popped by whatever percent. So Prop 22 is basically just wiping AB 5 out and saying, you guys can continue to engage them as freelancers. However, if they work a certain number of hours, you got to contribute to a healthcare fund and you need to make sure that some minimum wage laws are being followed. So it's somewhat of a middle ground. It's not the free-for-all that existed before AB 5, but it's not the hard clamp down and making everybody an employee, which AB 5 wanted to do.
One thing that I'm really curious to kind of get your thoughts on, that people have been, you know, talking about it, especially during the last kind of presidential cycle when I think it was Andrew Yang was the one that was really talking about it, this idea of like a universal basic income, or, you know, UBI, if people kind of heard that term thrown around. Do you foresee us potentially getting to that in America if, you know, more and more people are kind of considered on their own versus, you know, having a 401k that's backed by an employer or, you know, having a pension fund?
We can certainly dive into it. Look, I say no, and I say it quickly, and I say it forcefully to make the point that that is a substantial change to the social contract of the United States of America. Now, if UBI were at the forefront of every politician's voice right now, I'd have a very different point of view, because you see those kinds of changes, those fundamental restructurings of the economic relationship of the social contract, you see it very, very, very infrequently. But when you do see it, it comes along because there is huge economic dislocation. And I often like to say, you know, imagine a conversation in 1928 where a progressive thinking person said, you know, we should have unemployment insurance and welfare and we should provide Social Security. And their friend would rightly say to them, what are you, out of your mind? Like, we would never do that. That would never pass. Are you crazy? That is fundamentally changing society and blah, blah, blah. And you know what? If not for the Great Depression, I'm not sure it would happen in the United States. And I think we're all better off because of those programs. But UBI, to me, is a bridge too far outside of a tremendous, tremendous economic dislocation, which I think we can all hope does not occur.
No, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. When did you officially finish writing the book?
I officially went to content lock on the book in December of 2019.
You know, COVID appears roughly 3 months after you kind of finished writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
If there was something that, you know, let's just say you had three, 4 more months, what potentially would you have changed, or what potential other content would you would love to have added as, you know, we've kind of hit the crazy time that 2020 has given to us?
The thing that I definitively would spend more time on is remote work. I mean, look, pre-COVID, I would have made the statement, and did make the statement, that remote work, which went from 1.5% of the workforce in 2010 to 3% of the workforce in the beginning of 2020, would grow from 3% to 4, maybe 4.5% over the next 10 years. And instead of that, we'll now be at 8%. And that is a substantive change that was very clear. And when people say, oh, COVID has sped up the future of work, I would say, well, maybe, except when we're talking about remote work, because there it's 100% true. Like, it's 100% true, and we have the data. All the other things, whether it's an increased use of robotics and AI, whether it is changes to the on-demand labor force, whether it's deglobalization, whether it's concentration in the economy, those are things that we have good indications that COVID has sped up the future of work. But we really don't know yet. We need more data. But on remote work, we have all the data we need. This is incredibly, incredibly clear. It's just, is it 8% or 9%? Is flexible work arrangements 32 or 34%? It's all in those ballparks.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for the time. This has been an incredible conversation. And, you know, if people wanted to, learn more about, you know, your work, or they wanted to go and, find the book, where would they go and find that?
Well, Derek, I wish I could tell them they could go into any bookstore all across this great country, but I don't think that's going to be a reality for us for another couple of months. But anywhere online that fine books are sold, Amazon, obviously, first and foremost, but BarnesandNoble.com, and Simon & Schuster has it on their website, and whomever. And then anyone can, you know, reach out on LinkedIn. It's the only real social media network I use. I mean, I'm on Twitter, and I always tweet out about, you know, companies that I'm advising or invested in that are hiring, and on great articles about the future of work. But that's beyond that, I don't tweet that much.
No, perfect, perfect. And then, yeah, I'll make sure that I link to the book where people can actually find that in the show notes as well. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time. And, you know, hopefully when all this is getting a little bit back to normal, we can, meet up in person.
Very much look forward to it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Future of Work Project. Now, as with all of our work, this interview is part of our ongoing research, and I'd love to get your thoughts and feedback on the discussion. To weigh in, visit our website at fowproject.com or reach out on Instagram at @thefowproject. We'll be sure to share the feedback on our social channels, and it could be featured in an upcoming episode. And with that said, thank you for listening. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Future of Work Project. Now, as with all of our work, this interview is part of our ongoing research, and I'd love to get your thoughts and feedback on the discussion. To weigh in, visit our website at fowproject.com or reach out on Instagram at @thefowproject. We'll be sure to share the feedback on our social channels, and it could be featured in an upcoming episode. And with that said, thank you for listening.